We ready.
Bonnie Johnny, everyone. This is Professor Amon Ra, Professor Emeritus of Cal State University Long Beach Africana Studies Department. We want to welcome you to the Conscious Corner, and my co-host, historian and a longtime educator, Mr. Joe Hembrick, and we want to just get in right into the discussion this evening. There are three major trials going on that have a lot of perspectives from different people. The Rittenhouse trial that's over now, it shouldn't be, and we'll explain that now as we go. And then we have the Ahmaud Arbery trial. And then we have the Charlottesville trial of neo-Nazis and white races that's going on at the same time. They're making their closing arguments in the Arbery trial, as well as the Charlottesville. And so we want to get into that discussion, but we also want to discuss the exoneration of the two brothers that were accused of being a part of the assassination of Malcolm X. They did over 20 years, and now they found out that they didn't have nothing to do with it. But they're not talking about who did. So we're going to look at that also. So we're going to get started and get some various perspectives. It's a town hall meeting, a roundtable meeting. And we just want to get some perspectives from each person on. They can talk about any of the three trials. And that is the Rittenhouse, and the Arbery, and the Charlottesville, and the Malcolm X exoneration of the two men that did 20 years. One died, two of them. And so we'll get to that in a minute. So we're going to start off with Brother Mashinda. Mashinda, how do you see these trials, and which trial do you think is an example of challenges that we face as a people? You there, Brother Mashinda?
Well, good evening. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Do you think we should be concerned?
Of course. You know, I think it's more of a reminder. You ask, is that, you know, yeah, it's a reminder of what contributes to our challenges. You know, I mean, the legal system is you know, it's a wicked, wicked system. You know, you got money, or if you fit a certain classification, you know, you may get off, you know, those kind of things, you know. So I think that, you know, just looking at it, I mean, you know, Rittenhouse or whatever, that particular guy, you know, that show you that, I mean, it's just the order of the day, right? Now, I think, you know, in certain parts of our country, you know, in a lot of the centers of our country, you know, the different states and major cities, they ran by, you know, a lot of, you know, you got a lot of hate, you know, you got a lot of people believing a certain ideology. And so that judge, along with all the rest of them, you know, I mean, I thought it was a weak case, you know. I mean, a weak presentation that the prosecution put on, you know, and I didn't even look at it. I looked at the closing arguments a few minutes and what he was describing about the guy and how big he was and all that guy, you know, it just didn't sound. I said, oh, they're going to let him go. And so anyway, we just better keep our eyes open.
Okay, well, that's good. That's on the Charlottesville. Rittenhouse case. Is there any other perspective you have on the Arbery case, Mashinda?
Uh,
Are you following
it? Going on, right?
Yeah, they're in closing argument.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been, it's just like that other one. I have, you know, I understand what's going on, you know what I mean? But I follow it. And then when I hear the verdict, you know, I won't be surprised if it, you know, comes out certain ways, you know, reduction of sentences or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, it's kind of congruent with, you know, the Rittenhouse story, you know, same thing. You know, these folks are played in the media showing that, hey, I have a right to kill these people, you know, the brothers, you know, the young brothers running through the neighborhood, getting a little jog in, you know, but they must didn't want him around there. You know, it's dangerous times in a lot of these streets, a lot of these locations and things like that. So, you know, but I'll tune into it now that, you know, so I can, I'm going to be off for the next, for a little while. I guess they're going to have court tomorrow. Is that being televised like the Rittenhouse?
Yes, it is. Okay. I think, yeah. HLN. And okay. But I want you to. Okay. We'll get back to you after we go. What about you, Doc? What's your position on any of these trials?
Like I said, you know, Rittenhouse. You know, any time, man, you're in the state, and I'm believing the state was an open carry. Because he was able to walk around with his AR-15. I didn't think he was going to get convicted. It's open carry. So, I mean, both sides had guns. I mean, the guy that survived that he shot had a gun. You know, so that you know, that amazes me. He's supposed to have been on the side of the protesters, and he had a gun. Why did he have a gun? You know, so if the protesters have a gun, anti-protesters should have a gun. So wasn't shocked about the verdict. I think, you know, my opinion, you know, he shouldn't have been convicted. You know, you got a gun and someone's trying to take it from you, you got a right to defend yourself. And that's just the law down there. Here in California, it's not open carry. You know, you can only carry unless you got a, you know, license, CCW or something. So it'll be different here because our laws are different. They're very lax with the laws and the guns. So, and the other case with Arbery, you know, that's, it's all on video. You know, just in a video. He doesn't, you know, he's jogging. You try to pull him over. He has the right to defend himself, even though, he didn't get a chance to defend himself. In that case, they just blatantly murdered that kid. You can't say that, hey, I, you know, you said they're trying to use a citizen arrest thing. You know.
But they're saying it was self-defense.
He wasn't attacking anybody. He would defend, you know, self-defense on his part.
They said, but his fist was a deadly weapon.
Okay. Well, hey, if you can sell it to the jury, you know, that it was self-defense, hey, you get off. You know, that's the jury. You know, what I saw in the video was different. You know, I wouldn't be shocked to go any other way. If it goes, they get convicted, I get mistrial. I'm thinking more of probably a mistrial. But you know, it's just what happens all the time, man. So may get convicted, may not. No big deal. It happened again. We see what happened next time. Then what happened next time, we see what happens. And what happens after that, we'll see what happens. You know.
Okay. Okay.
And what was the third one? It was the third one you talked about. I'm not familiar.
We had the Charlottesville, we had the Aubrey, and we had the Malcolm X exoneration.
Okay.
So those are there. What about you, Rashiki?
I was looking at Democracy Now today, and the guy that got shot, Blake. His dad was on there. His uncle was on there. They were talking about the guy that had the skateboard. And the skateboard the guy supposedly had the skateboard was a friend of the son that got shot. You know, he had knew him. And so they were kind of focusing in on the people that actually got shot were being like heroes because they were trying to keep the Rittenhouse from killing other people. So they made it look as if the guys were good, you know, and what they were doing, they were supportive. The girlfriend of the guy that got killed, the skateboarder, his wife or his girlfriend was accompanied by Blake's uncle. So it was a kumbaya moment. And it's just more of the same, tilted towards white people, where they're going to be able to get off. And when it comes to black people, whole different story. So this is why we're here, to analyze, to learn, to give solutions to what people actually can do to avoid these situations. You know, we as a unit, we have to start looking at ways to not invoke police actions to the point where you're getting shot and all of that. So we have a lot to learn in this system, man. And you know, like with the Malcolm X case, the guys that got exonerated, it was kind of sad for me to see how many people are informants. It was sad to see those brothers sit in jail for that amount of time. J. Edgar Hoover making people be quiet and not give up evidence to exonerate those guys earlier. It's just we live in a real tough situation. And, you know, it's tough.
Okay.
That's my take on a few of those trials.
All right. Brother Hembrick?
I haven't really been keeping up with them. I knew the stuff was going down before it even started. You know, we must piggyback off what Roger Key was saying, you know, and not just the Aubrey case I'm speaking about, but in general, we have to learn to stop putting ourselves in situations where this stuff can occur. And you guys talking about the brothers that did the time for Malcolm. I saw some on the news today with these five brothers, forget the what they called them, the something four or five. They did 50 years allegedly behind raping some white girl, and they didn't do it. And only three of them are left alive now. Forget what that was. And then I looked
at it. I was in New York, the Central Park Nine.
Yeah, so, you know, and to bring in Malcolm, seemed like his stuff is still apropos. The only place to get justice is in the street. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to realize that we're behind enemy lines. Quit expecting to get some justice, because we're not. Unless some is highly, you know, publicized, politicized, like the George Floyd situation. If that stuff hadn't got that big with all that, he would have got off too. But they just couldn't let it happen that time. But anyway, that's my take. But I don't waste my time following these cases, because I already know the outcome before it even happened. And then when that judge said that you couldn't refer to those people that got killed as victims, I knew the thing was in then. You know, that's just straight out ridiculous. But anyway, is what it is, but we just have to stop putting ourselves. I was talking to somebody about the Aubrey case, and he don't really keep up with it. He said, does he have a father? And I'm sure he does. I don't know if he was around at the time, but he was saying, anybody that lives down in that area know that you don't go jogging through Klan Town at any time. I know everything's supposed to be free and justice for all, and you know, society supposed to be integrated. But where he was Trump flags flying everywhere. So, you know, the question is, I ain't taking away from a brother getting killed, but what was you doing over there in the first place? Jogging through all them people's neighborhoods. You know, if we even walk in a neighborhood like that, we finna get jammed. I don't know. I don't live in that part of the country. I just hear the stories. But I was talking to somebody from Florida who was telling me that down in the Southeast is known. So somebody should have been schooling that young man about, you don't be going over there making yourself a target just because you want to jog somewhere. I don't know. But what I understand, the brother was interested in contracting. That was the reason he looked in, you know, into that place where the work was going on anyway. But, you know, that was the reason for going to field as part of employment. I think he was going to school for it or something. But I knew that if it didn't get built up big like George Floyd's situation, this is about what's going to happen. It hadn't happened yet. We can pretty well bet a dime to a bucket of poo-poo that's what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day. So I don't know. What's the name of the organization? NFLA? And maybe they should have been marching, put some fear in them crackers, get them come through with the right verdict. Anyway, that's my spiel on the subject. It's just constant. Cycle keeps going on and on.
Appreciate what's been said, if I understand correctly. And I really deeply think that y'all have made some significant points. But I just wanted to go over a few things. I think that it's important that no matter how audacious, vicious, cruel, inhumane the system treats Black people, we can't normalize it. We can't say, well, it's just going to happen and that's just the way it is. You still got to speak truth to power and you still have to resist. Even Malcolm said self-defense and self-defense on all fronts, not just physical self-defense, but political, economical, and educational, because we're in this country as captives, former captives that have been here all our lives. We have paid taxes. We've joined the service. We've contributed labor, we've contributed entertainment, we've contributed to the arts, we've contributed to the science, in every aspect of this country's growth, we've contributed. And at the same time, we've kept our humanity by respecting our relationships with the Native Americans and coalitions and alliance with Latinos, as well as progressive Asians. And some of our organizations even deal with progressive whites. But we can't normalize their inhumane treatment of us or any other person. That's not normal. If it was normal, everybody would be doing it. And there's only one group of people that build institutions and finance that and develop political cover to justify their inhumanity. I mean, how do you justify the insanity that you see? You put it in the courts, you pass legislation that says it's okay for me to do what I'm doing. It's called democratic insanity. If everybody agrees that it's okay, then they can do it, no matter what it is. And so you don't normalize that. And then second, you don't become a collaborator. Well, you do, but we try to urge people not to become collaborators in blaming the victim. It's like, a woman being raped and the rapist saying, tell me you love me. Or the rapist saying, I'm sorry I had to tear your dress. The victim, as Joe was pointed out, when the judge said you can't call people that got shot in the Rittenhouse case victims, But you can't. That's okay. I mean, that's not okay. But the bad part was, he said, but you can't call them rioters and looters. These are dead people that got shot. Now, let's look at first the Wittenhauer case. And not only did the judge say that they can't be victims, you can't call them. So you turn the victim into the criminal by calling them looters and rioters. They're victims. And then you call Wittenhauer a person that's just defending himself. Now, let me just go with this. It's not no accident. His bail was $2 million cash. Let's start with his bail. They raised it. They put up a $2 million cash. His family and the first attorneys that, the attorney that defended him was his second attorney. He got rid of the first two. And now they're fighting over the $2 million cash that they raised through donations about their bill and about getting paid and that who's going to get that money. Second, they raised another $2-3 million for his trial. This is a passionate group of people that put up money and then that kind of money for his defense. And they had two mock juries that practice juries. They had an expert in criminal and how to be a witness, how to be an effective witness. They had an expert that teach you what type of jurors to pick out certain jurors and an expert in that. Not only did they have that, you see, as all of you said, they had the judge, they had the defense attorney, and they had the prosecuting attorney, and they had the jury. This judge, during the trial, they only had one black and on the jury. In the Wittenhauer case. The rest was all white. He said he shot in self-defense. And they didn't put the best attorney. It should have been a state attorney general that tried the case. Out of the state attorney general. But it's a little small town. The jurors was from the small town that Wittenhauer and that the murder took place. Now, I want you to understand that, that kind of money and passionate. The Fox News, the political atmosphere has treated him like a hero. They're trying to talk about he needs to be an intern. He needs to run for office. He's been featured on major networks. He's been lauded as a person that others should do. Now, second, they made a point that even the people that were in another rally that pulled guns on Black Lives Matter protest, they came down to give him support. The passionate aspect of this from a judicial and jurisprudent standpoint is profound. And so we have to look at it for what it really is and its implications. The other thing, it will embolden the people in the Aubrey case. If they can get away with letting him go, they can get away with a hung jury or even finding just one person guilty of a lesser crime, as the doctor pointed out, or either let them go because there's no consequences. Even though there's demonstration nationwide about the outcome, and there's been some certain celebrities that, say it's bad. But there has not been a major group of whites that stands up and say, hey, this is wrong. I mean, there's some progressive whites that's saying it, socialist, communist, but I'm talking about mainstream whites that's speaking against it. And this is a crucial aspect that we as all of you said, we better begin to get just as passionate about our justice and about our struggle as they are about oppressing, and really, as they see it, taking their country back from the minority. And future protests, people, and even during that trial, they talk about there were white people out there with AR-15s walking around the courthouse, and they had to tell them that they had to be X amount of feet away from the. Now, let me just say this. Wittenhauser can't be retried for murder because he got not guilty, double jeopardy. But the judge dropped the one charge, and that was him owning bringing the gun across the state line, as well as having having a gun, not being of the age to have a gun, to buy the gun illegally. So they can bring them charges back if they want to, you know. But then again, you know, it's a small gesture for the lives lost and the maiming of the young man that got shot in the shoulder. But anybody know they can bring those charges back, you know, even if the judge dropped them. Judges and ask for a change of venue because of this judge who had the people clap for veterans. One of the witnesses was a veteran. And he asked for all veterans to stand up. And the only one stood up that was there was the witness. And then you had the people clap for him. It was a witness for the defense. This is unheard of. You understand? But I've been a victim of judicial misconduct. So I understand it. But many people don't, because the civil rights movement depended on the courts. You know, that's why the NAACP, the Brown versus in Kansas City, like Tamika, wherever it was, various lawsuits and civil rights lawsuits, they depend on the court. But these are the same court, especially the Supreme Court, that ruled that Dred Scott, in the Dred Scott case, that white men don't have to respect the rights of black people. This was a Supreme Court ruling. And there have been hundreds of Supreme Court rulings against black people who filed for property rights, filed for human rights violations. The Supreme Court didn't even weigh in on the Tulsa, Oklahoma slaughter. You know, they left it to the states. You know, there's no federal investigation, a history of no federal investigation into what happened in Tulsa. You know, so you have to understand the courts are just as crooked and corrupt. But many of us believe if you get found guilty, that's okay. You know, I mean, and so we have to look at that. Now let's get to the Aubrey case. Here's a judge that says, I believe that doing racial discrimination in selecting the jury, but I can't do nothing about it because they're not using race as a reason. What they're saying is that, you know, they gave various reasons that they thought got around it, but it's suspicious to me. This is his judge. Anybody that know a judge could say, no, we're going to do another jury pool, or we're going to have to add, I'm not going to let you kick this person off. Judges do that all the time. Then defense attorney Goff jumps up and says, I don't want no black minister. Not, I don't want ministers. He said, no black ministers, because they are disrupting the church from the gallery, the trial from the gallery, and intimidating the jury. Then he got even bodacious. He put that in a motion. Then the next time he said, listen, Your Honor, the people that are demonstrating outside are so loud that is like a public lynching. He compared the black ministers to the Ku Klux Klan. And he compared a peaceful protest, a prayer protest, in support of the family as an example of a public lynching. Now, these are all dog whistles to the jury. That's all that is, and to the public, because, you know, it's all white jury, small little town in Georgia, as Joe pointed out, you know, about black people living way out there and all that. But the point is that that's just a part of it. You understand? Now, they're saying that the three men that chased Aubrey down and murdered him were acting in self-defense. The one guy that just drove his car and took the videos is being seen as a person that was a hero for doing the video, because they wouldn't have never did it. Now, it took them 3 months before they filed charges on these people for shooting Aubrey. Shooting him and to blame him, saying that he posed a threat, I was afraid, and that I could make citizens arrest. And the prosecuting attorney ripped all that apart. But in closing arguments, they're going back to the theme about, you know, this was self-defense. And so that, you know, whites feel more emboldened. Now let me explain this to you. In Charlottesville, the white nationalists are defending themselves. And they are asking questions to each other. And they're defending their right to be white and to be racist. And that the young lady got killed, they got them for, it's more like a civil case. And it's like, they're dealing with them being a conspiracy to charging the leadership with conspiracy to bring forth that caused the violence in Charlottesville. This is the same group that ex-President Trump said there was good guys amongst them that was yelling racial slurs, beating up people that they ran into, and yelling Jews will not replace us. And these are the same people that Trump said there was good people on both sides and defended their behavior. So I'm okay. So those are it. Now in the Aubrey case, going back to it, we as a people must be vigilant, and we must speak our special truth to power, and we must always stand up for what's right. We have always been the moral vanguard of the world. Martin Luther King said, the arc of justice is long and bends, but it always bends toward justice. We people borrow our songs around the world. They use our example of protest. And it may be in China, it may be in Poland, it may be wherever they are. They use nonviolence and they sang, "We Shall Overcome." And they use the same terminology that we introduced to the world for justice, human justice. So we got to look at that. Now let's get to Malcolm. You have people that said that they believe the FBI infiltrated the Nation of Islam, have agents join the Nation of Islam, on an assassin hit squad. For a long time, and that they were the real ones that killed Malcolm. There's a belief that the assassin, one of the persons that was assassin, he told them from the beginning that those two people were not there, was not a part of it. Now he's not telling the people who was a part of it. Now, the Nation of Islam never defended Malcolm, and they never said that they weren't a part of it. They just said he got what he deserved. So many people blame the Nation for not standing up and not vetting their membership. But people that were there at the Audubon when Malcolm was assassinated know that there was more than just the cop that was trying to resuscitate him, that there were federal agents throughout the audience, and that there was a person that got shot that don't nobody that has not been talked about, that was taken out the back door, and people saw him get in the police car and never seen. Now, this Netflix movie, Who Killed Malcolm, shared a lot of information on the conspiracy and the perspective of the conspiracy. Malcolm believed the Nation was after him, but people believed that, and even Minister Farrakhan, who I know very personally on a first name basis, he invited me to go back to Washington, D.C. to help plan and pay for my ticket and everything. Me and Maulana went back. And the second Million Man March was supposed to be the march of, he called it for covenant. And we changed it to the Million More March. And Reverend Stallings of the Imani Church, who broke away from the Catholics and started Black Catholic Catholicism and called the Catholic Church racist. He was there, Danny Bakewell, Minister Tony Muhammad, Dorothy Height. We was at the Dorothy Height Center that we was in. We was at the Dorothy, they just bought a building right there across from the White House in downtown Washington, D.C. And we was there along with Barbara Skinner, the women. And it was just a powerful and profound meeting. I still got my letter of invitation and everything that, you know, I take pride in that. Because I used to speak on, before Farrakhan would come on, they used to have me speak on many of their programs. And so, you know, I know him, but Farrakhan even said he created an atmosphere of hate for Malcolm. And he apologized to Betty and the supporters. Malcolm started a new group, and Waqf D. Muhammad was his imam and minister, and that was the Organization of African American Unity, the OAAU, modeled after the OAU, Organization of African Unity. And so he said that he wanted to deal more with politics, but the Nation was so into money, they just... Even during the 1965 rebellion, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad took all the Muslims off the streets. You know, there was no Muslims helping us in the rebellion of 1965. And so the point is that they were more inclined about do for self. And, you know, they saw, you know, their whole thing was about economics, economic development. And I'm not putting the Nation down. They did a lot of good. I mean, they had that program that took drug addicts and some people even with mental illness and turned them into outstanding people. They had a strict code, a dress code. You could, you know, you had to straighten up, clean up, you know, and pray and come to the mosque. And I mean, it was a good program. Malcolm built that program. Malcolm wrote the first national newspaper called the Muhammad Speaks. He started the Muhammad Speaks. Malcolm started their business chain of Shabazz Enterprise. Malcolm was one of the key, he was a disciplinarian, ate one meal a day. He only ate one meal a day. He was very disciplined. After he got out of prison, he became one of the most honest brothers out. After, you know, he was lumping before then. But that's why we loved him so much, because he was such a model of manhood. He was the only one. He was the number one voice. He introduced the slogans. If a cat climbed, for people who say that they are not Africans because they were born in America and that makes them American, he said, if a cat climb up in an oven and have kittens, that don't make the kittens biscuits. Just because you were born in America don't mean that you're American. He said, he also said, I'm not American. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm not an American. And I got sense enough to know it. But he also said this. He said, listen, Democrats are foxes and Republicans are wolves. They both belong to the dog family and they both are canines. That was a profound statement to say. In 1967, a brother named Earl Frazier, another brother named John Lewis, a brother named Michael Daniels, a brother named Walter Taylor, and a sister named Marlboro, we all met at Earl Frazier's apartment, Ralph of Greenleaf in Compton, and we listened to Malcolm Speaks to the Grassroots. And after we listened to that speech that Earl Frazier put on, we started the first BSU at Compton Community College. I was elected Sergeant of Arms. Earl was the president. After that, Robert Taylor took over, an ex-military man, and he became a Muslim. But anyway, we started it. And that's what led to the first Black president of Compton College. That's what led to the whole entree of Blacks that got hired. We broke that dominancy of whites that was over the Compton Community College in the community of Compton. But anyway, getting back to the point, Malcolm also said, by any means necessary. Everybody used that phrase. Yeah, he had so many phrases that we borrowed from that gave us a sense of solidarity and unity. Said, what kind of men are you to let them mistreat your women, rape them and beat them? But you go to Vietnam and shed your blood, but when it comes down to defending your own families and your own women, you ain't got no blood. That was Malcolm, you know, that shamed us and made us stand up. He put a board in our back, and his slang was stand up, get up, clean up, and stand up. I mean, it was just a beautiful thing if you ever listen to his albums and his run. And he defined Black nationalism, political, economical, and educational, and community. And he gave an in-depth definition of it. And that's when we began to call ourselves Black nationalists in the 60s. So, you know, Malcolm was, we say he's a martyr because we don't talk about them assassinating him. Just like they don't say that Jesus was assassinated. They say his sacrifice. So we say, we praise Malcolm for his sacrifice. Now they got schools back east, streets back east, named after Malcolm. Malcolm was treated like a diplomat in Africa. I mean, they wanted him to stay there. He knew he was going to be murdered when he came back. He said that. He was poisoned in Ghana. You understand? I mean, this brother was a profound leader, brother, profound leader. And he didn't want no money. He was living in the Nation of Islam house. They took him to court for eviction after they bombed the house. After he built them, they wouldn't even have the money they had, the members, if it wasn't for him. He said he deserved this, to lease a house out the deal as he left. And you know what? They didn't see it that way. They took him out and they won the eviction. And Malcolm had to move with his girls. So that's why we look at the Malcolm case is not as, okay, you exonerated the two, but we want a continuous investigation on who killed him and who financed it and who organized it, just like they're doing for the January 6th. We're asking our Black Congress people or some people to ask for hearings, testimony, and investigations that got the resources to find out who really assassinated Malcolm and see if they can be held accountable. All right. So that's what I had to say on all three. Oh, yeah. Let me just say this, and I just wanted to give a feedback. We're in challenging times. In all of America's institutions, racism is expanding. It's always been there. It's just expanding and more blatant and without shame. If you look at the courts, the Supreme Court, there's and people talking about the dark money that financed the white right-wing conservative element of the Supreme Court that has corrupted it. This is a court that turned down many appeals of Black people. Even the brothers that did the 20 years or more for Malcolm assassination, the courts wouldn't even hear their appeals. You understand? And if it wasn't for Project Innocence, the next flick, and all of that, they never would have got exonerated 20-something years afterwards. You understand? So we're being attacked by the courts. The Rittenhouse verdict was a court decision, corrupted. If you think it's not corrupted, you walk down the street with AR-16. The Panthers walked in Sacramento with unloaded guns, and they were had to leave the country, many of them. And the guns were unloaded, and that was it was illegal what they did. They didn't have no bullets in the gun. They just walked around Sacramento with them. And then they crushed them. Second, so the courts are just as corrupt. Just because somebody gets found guilty don't mean that they were guilty. You understand? I mean, you just saw that with the Rittenhouse. Think about it. You're 10% of the population and close to 60% of the people in the penitentiary, federal and state. They had to prosecute a judge in Texas for accepting money from private prisons for him sending Black people to prison. I mean, I just want you to understand how deep the courts are. You know, we can go and find a bunch of United States federal rulings that even though they ruled in Brown in Topeka, Kansas, that segregation is still high. Segregation is still high. And our schools ain't turned from Black to white. They turned Black to brown to Latino, you know, from immigration. And let me just go on. Then after the court, politically, suppressing the Black vote even worse. They always suppressed the Black vote, but it's just blatant now. Gerrymandering. This is a political system. This is how serious is it. These are whites that are saying, hey, look, we're taking our country back.
That's right. It's
not, yes.
I have to have you explain gerrymandering because a lot of people hear that. Yeah. They don't. It's just, can you put it in layman's term where people can understand what gerrymandering is?
Yeah, gerrymandering is when every 10 years of what they call the census, they do a population of analysis and they decide how to carve up districts based on population. Now, a guy named Jerry, I forget his last name, He was the first one that did it. He carved up a city, a line like a snake. And that's where the gerrymandering is, after a snake. And instead of a straight line, it was like a snake so that he can continue to be elected. You understand? He took his district and went around communities that he didn't think would vote for him and put him and made his district where people would vote for him. And that's where the term gerrymandering came from. Gerrymandering is practiced throughout. They even talk about in California, we're going to lose a congressional seat. They do it on a local level, city. They do it on a congressional and a state level, assembly level. Right now in Texas, they got Sheila Lee, who's sponsoring H.R. 40, the reparations bill, and supporting of the John Lewis bill and the human rights bill. They changed her district where she got to run against another congressman. I forget his name. In the same district, they put their districts together into one through gerrymandering. Governors. The determination of redistricting is different in different states. But right now, most governors are over the redistricting. That's why local politics is important. See, each state operates as an independent country. That's why they call it the United States. The governor is just like a president, but he's just president of that area, that governor, of that state. He has an army, it's called the National Guard. He has a state police, he has a state, a legislator. They collect state taxes just like the government collect federal taxes. The government collect income taxes, the state collect property taxes, and the counties and them, they collect what they call sales tax. And so you have to realize this, that's why it's deep, brother. Right now, if you buy a car in Compton and you try to, and you got so many taxes on top of it, that's why people sometimes, they want to get their insurance and they use another address because it's higher. It's called redlining and all kinds of stuff that happens to us. But that's what gerrymandering is. And so that's a part of the political process. Suppressing Black vote even more. They're already intimidated, discouraged to the point that most Black people don't even want to vote, don't like voting, don't even think about voting, don't even train their kids to vote. When you go to those, when you watch television and you see those mega rallies, so-called, mega rallies, Make America Great rallies, they have their kids there. They have a Ku Klux Klan youth camps that they take their kids to camp to learn how to be an excellent camp. Like, could you imagine the Ku Klux Klan having a youth camp? They do that right now. You understand? And they talking about, well, you know, when people say, well, they're not teaching whites to hate Black. They already do that. And everybody talking about, well, there's some good white people. And there are some on the individual level, on a personal level. Those three white people that were shot, the two that was killed and the one that got shot, they was defending Black Lives Matter rallies in support of it. They were allies. But also Cheney and Schwarzenegger, the civil rights people that were killed. They were killed. There was whites that were killed, and three whites and one brother. They killed people who supported Black people. Throughout history, they've done that, and so this is another example of that. You understand? And people say, "Oh, well, he just killed other white people." No, he killed white people that were supporting Black people. That was in alliance with the Black Lives Matter support, whether it be Tifa or whatever. And then the doc said, yeah, he's the guy had a gun. Well, you know, only person that shot their gun was Rittenhouse. There were a lot of people with guns. The police had guns. There were other vigilantes out there with guns. But the only person that killed anybody unnecessarily was Rittenhouse. He's the only one. Why didn't other people shoot? So nobody asked those questions. So anyway, getting back to the political. Economically, redlining, lack of loans to buy houses, to refurbish your house, to upgrade your house, all of that. You understand? And the biggest thing that the white right wing got is they got a passionate perspective that they put up big money. I ain't talking about no little money. I remember we had a documentary on the Ku Klux Klan that said they never worry about money. They got all the money. Channel 5 did a documentary on the Ku Klux Klan and showed the presidents that were supported and some that were members former presidents, Truman and a bunch of others. And I, our people don't educate ourselves. Our parents didn't want, they treated politics like we don't talk about sex and we don't talk about politics. You know, they put them on the same level. You know, they didn't want us involved in politics. You know, I mean, our parents didn't say from the time, when you get 18, the most important thing you can do is register to vote. And while you're 12 and 13, 11, we're going to have you go to school board meetings. They're financing white wing people to run for school boards to get rid of Black history and ethnic studies and what they call critical race theory. They got it. They're fighting that school board meeting. And they found out there was a rich white people that is financing and organizing people to run for school board to take that position. So from a political standpoint, economic standpoint, an educational standpoint, you already talked about the problem of having education. But anyway, those are the institutions that have become so emboldened that there ain't no shame. They can lie and they don't care because they've been lying all the time. Everyone talking about the big lie about Trump. Trump, the big lie is that slavery was our fault. The big lie was the Native Americans were savages and we brought them civilization. This country is built on lies and crime. But anyway, any response?
Professor Ron.
Yes.
I think that was an excellent analysis of the cases and Malcolm and some other things that we needed to know. Although what this tells me is, and it furthers my cause, is that we have to change. We, you know, with all you said, they're in training to keep what they have going, which is white supremacy. So we have to be in training to counter that. And I think with your in-depth analysis and information, that's a part of helping us. But I challenge, you know, all people, not even only Black people, but people of color in general, we have to change our ways. I mean, it's a must. We can't keep doing what we're doing. If they have training camps for Ku Klux Klan members as little kids, we need counter training camps. We need counter political offices to be ran for and things of that nature. So we have to, just like Brother Hembrick say, that we have war. So we have to become, you know, soldiers in this war against what we're up against. So I'm very appreciative of your analysis and information, and I'm glad you're doing that.
Let me tell you one thing. Those people that was marching in Charlottesville, those weren't old white people. Those were young people. Look at that rally. Those were young, college, young age people. You know, in their 20s, they send their kids to places like Citadel and West Point to learn leadership and how to defend this country, this racist country, and to keep it the way it is. And so my point is that we have to continue the struggle. It's not that we have to change. Some people just got to get involved. There are many organizations out there that are doing beautiful things, fighting for our liberation, continuing the struggle. Black Lives Matter, in Cobra, they just had a meeting with Sheila Jackson Lee in Texas, in Cobra, along with Hakeem Ahadibuti and a number of other Black leaders to talk about reparations and the historical dynamics of our genetic retention of oppression through the Holocaust of enslavement that justifies a reparation. You got organizations that's already in existence that are doing beautiful things on their level and with the resources they have. Well, we need an overarching one to bring all them groups together and develop a sense of education. And we have to be prepared to defend ourselves. People don't think that these people would do us like they're doing other people, have people at the border trying to go to another country to escape oppression. They have us down there in Mexico trying to go to Mexico to get away from them because they're just shooting people in the streets because they got armies and things of nature. Now, there'd be some black resistance, but there'd be black collaborators. They infiltrated every black organization and even churches. Martin Luther King organization was infiltrated. The Urban League was infiltrated. On all fronts, they finance and they want info. And it's big money in Uncle Tom. You can become a Supreme Court justice. You can become a congressperson. You can become a citizen, a mayor. All you have to do is just support white supremacy. Go ahead, Doc. Do you have any response?
No, I agree with everything you said. This is my issue. I like everything you said. Everything you said was right. But the problem is, you're saying it with your heart. We're not looking at reality. There's a difference between reality and your heart. And I want to use an analogy of what you just said, something earlier, the Rittenhouse case. We were talking about the guns. The other side had guns. Big difference is that kid had a gun and he was prepared to use it. And he used it. The other guy that he shot had a gun. Didn't use it. He brought a gun to an event and wasn't prepared to use it. And that's just like us. Like Ross Key just said, we got to make a change. We got to do all this. We got to do all that. We're like that guy who brought that gun to the event and wasn't prepared to use it. We're going to keep losing to these rent houses because he brought a gun and was prepared to use it and he used it. That's our problem, man. We're not prepared to use that gun. And that's just analogy. I'm not talking about real guns. You just stated, we got all this, we got all that. And I agree, you need to bring all these organizations together. These lots out there, all these little groups got their little things. And like you said, once you get big, you're going to get infiltrated. Black Lives Matter, they got infiltrators in there from the federal government, CIA. Because once you start a black group and it reaches out globally around the world to different countries, CIA gets involved. Using this locally, the feds gets involved. So you're going to get a group. You're going to always have your infiltrators, just like you said. But the main thing is you can't bring a gun to an event and be afraid to use it. Why bring it? You leave it at home if you're not going to use it. You got to be prepared to use that gun, man. And if that guy would have used that gun, if he were prepared, the Rittenhouse trial would have never went on because he would have killed Rittenhouse. We would have never had this trial. But he wasn't prepared, man. So it was a waste. That gun was a waste. He was a waste. And that's just my point.
Yeah. But there are black people that use guns all the time. They use it in the army. They use it on the streets. Somebody got shot at the Willowbrook Metro station today. He shot a dude in the head and the police shot him. People use guns. Using them on?
But what I'm saying, is, like I said, with that example is, the guy brought a gun. He wasn't prepared to use it. Rittenhouse was prepared to use it. And you said something else about the cases. I didn't know all the money that he raised. Like I said, I wasn't following it. And you gave a clear, descriptive detail why that guy was going to get off. I didn't know all that. If I don't know that, I would have put, if it was a betting line on it, I would have bet the house on it. All the money he raised and all the people, groups are backing him. To get off? Oh man, I didn't know all that. That was a clear not guilty. But like I said, my thing is, man, you know, you just got to be prepared, man. You can't, you know, prepare to do something, don't do it, you know, freeze up, you know, you're no good. You're no good. And you said, let me ask you this. You said blatant. You said the blatant racism. It's so blatant now. So why is that different from... Yeah, so more blatant. So why is it different from back then? And now since it's more blatant, I don't get it. It's the same though, right?
It's more blatant and more intensified because of the movement of people and the whole movement of the Trumpism from the standpoint of taking over institutions. In other words, at one time, they just come in our houses, just pull us out and hang us. They're killing us even more with their institutions, with their policies, under the camouflage of law and under the camouflage of legislation. They're passing legislation such as voter suppression. They're passing legislation and making judicial system that says you can shoot protesters. All you have to say is that you thought your life was in danger. That was that ruling, set a precedent. You have to see it from the standpoint of them using, they've always, that's why they call it systemic racism, institutional racism, because it's the institution. And it's the white, as Martin Luther King would say, that will not stand up to it. They say there's some good whites. Okay, yeah, to marry you, to go to games with you, to drink beer with you. But would they stand up and fight their own people for justice and speak out against the injustice on a level? They're voting for these people. Look who they're voting for. Marjorie Taylor, look at the racist. Here's a man, you pointed out something so beautiful, Doc, last week, and Rocha Key sent it to me, about the black girl who drew a gun. And they had a police investigation, wouldn't let her talk to her parents or nothing. Here's a congressman that creates a cartoon, a video, killing a congresswoman. And going to attack the president, their president of the United States, and they make him a hero. A hero. Nobody in his party is condemning him. You see, that's the type of blatantness. They've always been blatant. Everything about, they had black people in slavery for over 100 plus years. They wiped out every Indian they could find, and now they have Thanksgiving. Being thankful for killing the Indians, and they're the ones that taught them how to eat and gave them the food that the feast. I want you to understand how they don't have no shame. And as Joe always pointed out, the big lie is that Jesus is white. You understand? Hey, look, they have a thing on my name, Amun-Ra, saying, well, that's really a Hebrew name. And it goes way back. But they never say that at that time the Hebrews were black. You know what I'm saying? You understand? So it's an African name because they were African before they were Hebrew. I just want you to understand the history of them distorting his style. They have no shame. And as far as believing in big lies, they've always believed in big lies. They got a big, fat white man they call Santa Claus. The first thing any psychologist with any education tell you, don't lie to children. Don't lie to children. And they take their kids and say, Santa Claus gonna bring you this. That's a lie. You understand? Tell the truth. You understand? Of these people, there's no shame. There's no shame. They're not even embarrassed for what they're doing politically and talking about Trump won. And none of these people would speak out against it because they're afraid they, for whatever reason, and he got a doctrine that say we're going to make America great again, meaning make America white again. And that's what they're voting for and acting like and working right next to you and living right next to you. It's like Big Bob used to say, they play with you all day, and at night they go to Klan meetings, and the next morning after a lynching or a killing, they say, we all need to hang our head in shame. And we're so sorry what happened. And they were the ones that did it. But go ahead. Joe, you have anything to say?
Hey, can I say something before that?
Yeah.
Hey, Ross, here. I mean,
Brother Doc. I just missed the last set. I had to step away for 1 second. Like, I just missed your last 30 seconds, Ross. I don't understand what he said.
But basically, he was saying what Neely Fuller said. They play all sides of the fence.
Right, you know, and like I said, I was listening to you, Professor Rock. I mean, did you expect anything different from them? You think they all of a sudden overnight they're gonna grow a heart
It's not people like me and you. It's people that don't even know that there was a trial. That we have a generation that is more important about the latest Snoop Dogg record than it is about politics, about the things that affect their lives. Snoop making an album ain't gonna affect their lives. They're just gonna party. But when you start talking about, hey, being political, being educational, there's no reason for our children not to learn skills, vocational, and be excellent in them. I used to tell my class that, Rasha Gia tell you, there ain't no reason for you not to get an A, not to be excellent. It's not because you want to just get an A to impress white people, but you want knowledge. And you want to be able to live. You work hard while you're young so you can kick it while you're old. But you want to know what's going on in the world, not just in the music industry or in the ball. You got black men today, millions of them watching football. People running up and down, knocking the hell out of each other to please white people. You understand? It's all based on war. It's based on war. It's a win-lose. Our cultural apparatus in athletics and entertainment was cultural exchange and win-win, appreciation for the art. It wasn't no losers. And many of the games we did, it was always a test of skills, a beauty. Our dances had a message in it. Our songs had a message in it. Here's a guy that promotes, I mean, everything is win-lose. I mean, big money behind betting, referees cheating. I don't know what else to tell you. You know, I mean, I remember when we were playing ball, they wouldn't even play black shoes. Remember Shaq Harris? He went in the Pro Bowl because a coach chose him. They didn't elect him to go to the Pro Bowl. He became the MVP of the Pro Bowl. And do you know the next year he had to sit and be a second string quarterback to Pat Hayden, who was just coming out of college? But here's a brother out of Grambling that was throwing touchdowns for the Rams after touchdown, but they didn't believe in starting a black quarterback because they thought it would affect the attendance and the attendance wouldn't allow it.
Hey, yeah, Rob. Yeah. What about Doug Williams?
Doug Williams was not the first. He won the first Super Bowl, but Doug Williams was
saying what happened to him. Next year, he was out. Mark Griffin became the quarterback. You know,
man. I know Doug well. Hey, man. But, hey, man, brother, Hembrick know the history of blacks. And they wouldn't even have black quarterbacks or black centers or black middle linebackers. Anybody that handled the balls or called plays were not black when we was coming up. You understand? They had a brother that played, you know, Moon, Diamond, was that his name? What's Moon who played for University of Washington? I think his name was John Moon.
No, Warren Moon.
Warren Moon.
Yeah, played for Houston all them years.
Yeah. I mean, he had to go to Canada first, remember? They didn't draft him as a quarterback. He had to go to Canada to play quarterback. You understand? I'm just trying to tell you, but I ain't even into that. Listen, you know what, man? I played sports. You understand? I wouldn't have never went to college if I didn't get scholarships to play basketball. You understand? But I was already black conscious when I came to school and when I got on the team, and I was the only one out of 8 brothers on the team. It was 9 of us. And I was the only one that graduated on time with this class. You understand? Because the coaches took over their lives, filled out their applications, filled out their financial aid form, told them what classes to take. And they didn't have to go to the classes. They got high. They ended up with women. I'm up there hustling grades, brother. I was an honor student. Because, you know, I didn't know I was going to be a professor. I didn't know I knew I was going to get a college degree, not because I wanted it, but because it opened up doors. They think that once you get a college degree, they got your mind. They gave it to you. You understand? Hey,
well, listen, Rob.
Yeah.
Let me tell you. When I finished basketball in 88, I got my degree in 93. And they did an article on me saying that I was the third player of the whole basketball program to get a degree in years. That's how ridiculous it was. I'm talking about of all the players. In the span of 10 years, the third person to get a degree in the program, ridiculous. Yeah.
But a lot of the cats didn't go to school to get a degree. That's the point. You understand? They went there to play ball, dreaming of the NBA. You understand? And dreaming of going across the seas to play. I was offered 2 tryouts with the NBA team and to go across the sea. I said, I'm not, if you didn't draft me and give me a contract after all the years I didn't play the game, I'm not going nowhere. And I was offered a professorship and head of Black Studies, and I took it. Most of the cats that graduated with me that went to pro didn't last over past their years of contract. Even Radliff, after his 5 years, he was out. He was just lucky enough to get rich with property and industry and whites and others helping him. But the rest of the players, man, them cats, I was a professor for 34 years. They played ball for 4 years. You know what I'm saying? Glenn McDonald helped the Boston Celtics win the championship. He got a ring. They cut him the next year. You understand? Don't tell me about them. For white people. You know what I'm saying? So, hey, it's a struggle, but it's a beautiful struggle. I love the struggle. It's a good day to struggle every morning for me. But, Rasha Key, unless somebody has something else to say, let's close it on out. You there? Rasha Key?
Yeah, what happened with Brother Joe? Brother Joe is...
He's not there. Let's just move
on. Okay, so here we go. Let me share the screen. We got Peter Rogers coming back on. Macro and micro relationships. How to bring the reconciliation process. So he talked about the 3 R's or the 4 R's, and reconciliation was one of those. So he's going to get deeper into that
and that's on Wednesday. And then who we got next week for you, Professor Rye?
I think Kawuma's going to come in and talk about what happened to McClain, the young man that they killed in Denver, and what's going on in Denver, and various Black issues nationwide and locally.
Okay, good, good. So who's tell us who Kawuma is.
Kawuma is Omar Montgomery. That's my son. He's director of diversity of some Creek school district, one of the biggest school districts in Aurora and in parts of Denver, and one of the richest school districts. And he was former director of Black student services for the University of Colorado and an adjunct professor. But now he's a full-time director of diversity for a school district. And he's going to come in and talk about all of that.
That's excellent. That's a classmate of mine. We both graduated the same year at Long Beach State. Excellent individual. Right. Excellent individual with good information and a lot of accomplishment. Looking forward to that. Okay. Well, each one teach one.
All right then, brother.
Conscious Corner.
All right then. Later, brother.